What does the future hold for Munster and Leinster? Why did Rog pretend to buy milk every Sunday morning? And Kev tells us what got the retiring Mike Ross fired up. It's all coming up on The Hard Yards.
The Hard Yards, brought to you by Ladbrokes. Passionate about sport.
And Ringrose comes through. Oh. That is brilliant from Ringrose. Ringrose is going here. What a score.
I know what website you use most often, but it's a sister of YouTube.
Hi Rob, Zeeb's here. Just want to discuss the captaincy next year.
He's calling.
I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field, not you.
I'd say YouTube is probably YouTube.
Hello and welcome to episode 13 of The Hard Yards, the Sports Show Rugby podcast. I'm joined this week by Ronan O'Gara, Kev McLaughlin and Pat McCarry. And later on we'll get odds from the weekend's Pro 12 action from Hayley O'Connor of Ladbrokes. If you're listening to the podcast for the first time, subscribe to it on iTunes, Podcast Republic, Stitcher and every good podcast app to get it straight to your phone. First up, Mike Ross is retiring, stalwart of Leinster and Irish rugby. Rog, start with you. He actually started off down in Munster. He's a Cork lad. Do you remember the old Rossi or the young Rossi?
Yeah, I would have been gone out of Conn by the time I think he was playing there. And he has a similar path. He was UCC Cork Conn, I think. And then obviously got a great and hard apprentice and excelled with Leinster and with Ireland, obviously, as well. I don't remember him personally at the start, but he was always a man that got a fair few butt of the jokes. I think that's what I remember of Mike Ross in his early days. I think people took out their kind of their anger or their frustration on Mike Ross because he was nearly an easy target, and he was absolutely an incredible person. I think he is. I was fascinated just to kind of watch him when he was in Irish camp, and I think talk about a guy maximising all of his capabilities. It's a great case study in Mike Ross. I think he's had a phenomenal career, and he should be incredibly proud of what he's achieved. He's a great guy, hugely interesting, hugely intelligent. I think you talk to guys who know about the forward game, and he took on the project at the scrum and absolutely, I suppose, stalled himself into becoming the best student of the prop in game he could become. And that took hours and hours and weeks and months of hard work. And I admire people like that who roll up the sleeves and find a way to succeed. And was he the best athlete? No way. Was he carrying probably excess weight? Was his DEXA scan impressive? No, but he found a way to compete at the highest level, and I tip my hat to him.
And he was he replaced John Hayes, which was, I suppose, no easy thing, but a very necessary thing from Irish rugby's point of view.
Incredibly difficult thing to do, because it was only when John Hayes was gone people realised how good he was and what he meant to the team. But you look at Irish rugby for the last 15 years, and we've been blessed in the fact that you had two cornerstones in Hayes and Mike Ross. And once you have a tight head prop that your teammates believe in, it gives you everything. Because people that don't play the game wouldn't realise, if you can get parity or even a 5% advantage on the tight head side from a back's point of view, it opens up the playbook completely for me. And with the two of them, we were always in good hands.
Yeah, we had him on the podcast a few weeks ago now, but it's very clear that Mike Ross loves three things. Scrummaging, love of barbecue, and technology. I'm not really sure which order that's in, Kev.
You're being very complimentary and just narrowing it down to barbecue. I think you just put in grub there. Grub.
Yeah, I don't think he could put them in order either. I think he's just so passionate about all three of them. I think a lot of what Rog said there would resonate with me. Like, he's a very quiet guy. He's a very deep thinker. He's the kind of guy who just came and got his job done. Like, the amount of study and prep and work he put into the art of scrummaging was phenomenal. Me as a back rower, I went through a transition in Leinster while he was there because of him, from someone who would switch off at scrum time and actually just all I'd be thinking about is the next play, to Jesus Christ, Rossi would be screaming at me on Monday if I don't put my shoulder in here and work for the 20 seconds of the scrum. So he completely shifted the whole mindset in Leinster in terms of what the scrum means, not just for the front rowers, but it's an 8-man job. And he was absolutely instrumental in that. We went from having a scrum that used to get walked around the park to a scrum that could actually compete in Europe and allow us to go and win a championship and compete with, say, the likes of Northampton in a final. And he just had that look, like, you wouldn't notice him in a game, and then it would come to scrum time and he'd turn around, he'd beat his chest, and you could see him screaming at the back. He'd come to life, he'd get excited. And that was the way, that kind of says a lot about him. And yeah, like, he has the technology side as well. He's something that he's also very, very passionate about, and I think that's probably going to serve him very well in terms of his next career.
Fingers crossed. Pat, now, would you have come across him much from the media point of view?
Yeah, and he was actually, he was a good guy for, sometimes you would think you get a prop, you're going to be absolutely screwed over, you'll get nothing from him, but Rossi...
He was a good guy, you're not having any digs at anyone there, Pat. he didn't snarl at us or kind of rise up to heaven. I wonder who that game that cheers, Pat.
Well, I suppose, yeah, he didn't.
He was a good guy.
He was a good guy, as in, yeah, you got some decent stuff out of him. And you you didn't get the same old kind of generic stuff out of him as well. So what is it? That's what I kind of liked about him. And then the other thing was, I remember speaking to him after they got knocked out of the World Cup to Argentina there in Cardiff. And I had assumed he was going to retire after that because it was after World Cup. And I had said to him, you know, is this it for you? And he was like, no. He's like, I might not be wanted, but as long as I'm never going to retire playing for my country, as long as I'm playing, I'll still be available if they want me. So I thought that was a nice touch. And there's a guy who's kind of done really well and never really got that send off. But it is good to see this week he's getting some nice words said about him, because he definitely put a shift in for his country.
He is, and he's given us Tadhg Furlong as well. I think, you know, he's moulded him into the next tight head, hopefully the next umpteen years. Now, we'll move on. Last weekend turned into something which was a good weekend of rugby to watch, but not the results that Irish rugby wanted. Hugely disappointing defeats for Munster and Leinster. We won't reflect too much on the intricacies of the match, but we are going to look forward and see what these teams do to take it up a notch next year. So let's start with Munster. That was on Saturday afternoon. What did they learn last weekend? Kev, from your experience watching the game now, what do you think that Munster learned? What will they take into, I suppose, not just the end of the Pro 12 season, but next season and beyond?
Yeah, I think you have to look back a little bit to look forward, and I think Munster and Razi Rasmus will be incredibly disappointed, I think, in terms of the way they played and how they actually went about trying to win this game. I don't think they ever fired a shot in the Aviva. I think like, what really highlighted for me was when Saris were down to 14 men and they weren't playing particularly well. They made a lot of mistakes, and Saris could easily have had a breakaway try early in the game. They dropped the ball and they kind of left the door open for Munster, and I just don't feel like Munster went for it. And I don't think Blaindall and Williams, like, a lot of people are turning on them a bit, but I just don't think they've looked to me like they didn't feel comfortable with the game plan. They're kicking the ball, slowing it down, and just trying to, it was like they were trying to take the wind out of Saris, but for me, like, they actually had to just go after them and attack and play and get in their faces. So, like, there's several different things. Like, the hardest thing after losing a game like that is actually looking inwardly and looking at yourselves and saying, how can we be better? And asking those really hard questions of yourselves. And it comes under certain categories. It's like, do we have good enough players in the squad? What were our tactics like? Are we fit enough? Are we mentally tough enough? And, like, all these really hard questions, like, I think Roger will agree, the coaching staff are going to ask hard questions of themselves, but then the players, they need to sit down and decide what they can do to be better, because if they're going to go a step further, for me, they never really once looked like beating Saris at the weekend. And, like, that's a really, really hard conversation to have as a group of players. And I don't know who in there, Roger will have better insight, who in there is going to grab the team together and say, guys, what are we going to do here to get better?
Yeah, I think that's very valid, Kev, what you're saying there. But I think where that is exactly the mindset of, I think, teams that have won Champions Cup, like the players in Leinster you did, the players in Munster that I did. But you have to, I think, go back and just, I suppose, appreciate the mindset of these players. I think, for me, they didn't anticipate the jump up from a Pro 12 to the semi-final of a Champions Cup. And I also felt that if you consider where they were 12 months ago, they were scrambling to get into the European Cup. And I think, for me, the biggest thing is that, you know yourself, when you get to the top four of a Champions Cup, it's like starting the competition again. The level just goes to a whole new level because it's the cream of the cream. You can get away in group stages with a, as we saw in Munster's case, that game plan works 90% of the time, because what are Munster do, they're direct and they run over people and they get up and they work around the corner and they're really hard working for each other and they bash up 12, gets over the gain line and they end up breaking down teams. But like a team like Saracens, as you said, they just lapped it up and they just said, is that all you have? Because we've done our homework, we're not going to contest the ruck too much, we're going to win our one-on-one contacts. And as you saw, it was probably the greatest mismatch of a semi-final we have seen it at that stage of a competition.
It was interesting now to think back to the conversation last week in the podcast where Stephen Ferris talked about the black wall across the field, and mm-hmm. you really did see that, especially in the first half. There weren't a lot of points scored. Indeed, Munster took the lead, so you took a 3-0 lead. It was 6-3 at half time, but at no point did you really think that Munster were in that game. It was very, very odd to watch. The kicking part of that, Rog, this seemed like an obvious game plan. Glasgow, in their limited bit of success in the quarterfinal, had that through kicking. Was this just their be-all and end-all of, this is how we get past the Saracen side? Because it didn't look, from my point of view, as if there was a plan B.
No, I think there would be a plan B, definitely. I think what Saracens are so good at is, and it gets exaggerated for every halfback trying to play against them, their performance is looking awful lot more abysmal than they are because of the pressure. Not alone that the back row put on you, but every single one of their players, I think, have an incredible defensive line speed, which other teams cannot sustain. Other teams can match it, but they can't sustain it for the 80 minutes. And there's examples throughout that game where Munster were under severe pressure. But what also Saracens do very well is that they really load the front line, and unless you have a really accurate kicking game, you won't get the rewards. And Munster's kicking wasn't accurate enough, and hence I think that's why it become probably amplified, why Munster didn't execute pretty well. But if you analyse Saracens, they're good at the back. He has 40 to 50 metres of space on either side of him, but you have to have a plan about who's going to get the ball and who's going to contest the ball. For me, I think there was too much height even in the kicks. If you were looking to win an aerial contest, because those kicks have to be kind of fast zip kicks, no higher than probably the height of a crossbar. And picture that across the pitch. I think if you were going to, in the attacking kicking zone, it's if you probably, have a look at Bowden Barrett's quality of kicking at the minute, I think he's the kind of guy that could exploit Saracens. But as you say, there aren't many Bowden Barretts around playing in the Champions Cup.
We'll move on to the Sunday game, to Leinster. This looked really, really bad about 15 minutes in, really, really bad. And then suddenly it turned into one of, I think, the great semi-finals. Kev, from your point of view, what will Leinster take from this game?
I think they'll take that you can't give a team a 15-point head start. I know that's a cliche. But they didn't play for the first half an hour. They overthrew, I think, three lineouts, or messed up three lineouts. Like, real basic things. They just kept letting Claremont into the game. And then, having said all that, I think they went in, it was 15-3 or 15-6, and you could tell it was going to be on in the second half. I knew straight away Claremont would begin doubting themselves. I think Rog said a couple of weeks ago, you stay with them for 40-50 minutes and they do doubt themselves. They're mentally a bit fragile. And I think Leinster had them. They had them completely where they wanted them, and then that disallowed try just shifted the whole momentum, 10-point swing. Totally unnecessary. I think Dan Levy's probably been Leinster's best player this year, but that was just inexperience. I think what we were always taught for those particular plays, those Joe special plays, is let the first player go. So he lets Ruggieri go, Ruggieri pisses out to the far wing, and then all Levy has to do is stand up and step forward, and whoever the next defender is has to run around him, and we're through the gap and the try scored. So it's just basic little things that you learn in those games of that are that tight. like the margins are so close, and I think like there'd be great learning for the likes of Levy and Jack Conan. And I think like if Sean O'Brien and Jamie are starting that game, it's probably a little bit different, and those little margins will probably swing Leinster's way. But it was very disappointing. I think the lads will be extremely disappointed, but I think from Leinster's point of view, I think they're looking at that game and saying, we were there, we had enough to win, I think we have the players, and I think like they'll be ready to go at it again next season.
Rog, I'm thinking back to the journey that Munster went on, I suppose a number of years ago now. There might be a game like Northampton in 2000. From your own experience, who were the players that drove the belief? You know, the belief that yes, we are good enough if we change this, that and the other to get to the next level. Who drove that in your time?
Do you know what? Everyone drove it, because I think that's... There's certain names that get the headlines, but it's absolutely imperative that... every member of the squad is valued, because for me, I always go back to people like Dennis Leamy, who spoke maybe once every 3 months, but when he spoke, you get goosebumped, because it just had like, God, I wish that guy spoke more. But he had a way of preparing and a way of performing, and his actions overpowered everything. But like, it comes down, I suppose, to internal ambition and what you want out of it, and unless that's driving you in training to be the best every day, it's nothing that you can just switch on. I think it has to be burning deep inside you, and that's what I think the Munster and Leinster squads are particularly lucky, that there's so many homegrown players, because if that becomes diluted and all the lads don't have that will to perform for their local people, for me, it just won't, they won't be able to compete, because the market is becoming richer and richer.
Yeah, like I remember after 2008, we lost to Castaway. It was Cheka's first year, and I'll never forget this. Like, it was a very, very powerful moment in my career when so Cheka came in to address us after the game for the Monday meeting, and a couple of the senior players asked him to step out of the room. He was like, "Chex, we've got this," and we sat around in a circle, the players. We didn't look at any video, do anything like that. Basically had an honesty session. And I remember some of the guys who I thought were flawless at the time, I was new in the Leinster squad, some of the superstars putting their hands up and saying, "I was absolutely rubbish at the weekend. I didn't prepare properly last week. My head wasn't in it." And like, when I saw these guys who I thought were flawless putting their hands up and saying, "I wasn't at the races, I made this mistake here," I immediately was reevaluating everything I was doing in terms of my rugby career, and I could see everyone else was the same, and that created something very powerful. And I think like the coaches are always going to do their reviews and try and drive change and try and improve, but it needs to be player driven. There needs to be a drive within the playing group, and I think that for me was one, like, a key turning moment in terms of Leinster's fortunes over the coming years.
Would it have been anybody in particular, like, you kind of stepped up, like one of the...
Yeah, it would have been like the usual names that get mentioned. It would be like Leo and Shane Jennings, and it would have been Brian O'Driscoll, obviously Shane Horgan, like those kind of key stalwarts of the Leinster, and they were the ones who were putting their hands up and saying, I was totally unacceptable at the weekend, and I was looking at them kind of going, wow, okay.
Yeah.
You know, I there's so many areas. If they're being that hard on themselves, like, how hard do I need to be on myself to get to their level and get beyond their level? So, like, it was... I just think that's really powerful. I don't know whether you guys, Rog, had any kind of moments like that.
No, I completely agree with you. And you just clicked something with me there in terms of what you said. It's usually the guys that aren't central roles in the national team that are the biggest drivers at provincial level. Like, in terms of my year, exactly, I knew exactly that it was, you know, I mean, people, I suppose the strongest influences in Leinster rugby would have been Leo, Shane Jennings and Shane Horgan, because the three of them weren't featuring for Ireland, so they had a double kind of a cause in terms of driving what Leinster meant to everyone. And then when the internationals came back, their house was in order. In our case, it was always the guys that didn't feature on the national team as well. You could taste, you get a feeling for how successful we would be by the interest levels or the drive out of these players that weren't on the national team. And I think if you have that, it becomes really, really powerful, because you, not alone do you have, I suppose, the lads that are in tip-top shape coming back from Ireland camp, but your bread and butter is your Munster and your Leinster. And if the guy's attitude and their foundations and their base levels are good, I think the capacity to do something special was always there.
So let's look a little bit further ahead. These are the players that are here. There's obviously a job that they have to do, the coaches have to do, but there's also the recruitment angle to this. So Leinster have recruited fairly strongly already. Scott Fardy coming in, James Lowe coming in from Super Rugby. That's some big names to add to the locker, especially in the back three. That's going to be loaded for Leinster next season. Munster bringing
James Lowe looks brilliant.
Yeah,
no, he's a good player.
It's going to be seriously impressive.
And then, he looks brilliant.
So those seem to me to be names that can push you up to another level here. Have we got the same in Munster with Hart, Farrell and JJ? They might not be quite at that level. You know, I mean...
I like the look of... Like, I think they've recruited well in Hart and Farrell. I like Farrell as a player as well. I think he'll fit in really well at Munster. But... yeah, like Hart will kind of he'll be that. You know, it's good to kind of have him there as well. JJ, it just remains to be seen whether he comes back and hits the ground running, whether he has that hunger when he gets back, and you know, because
no doubt he'll have the hunger.
Yeah,
no doubt about. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. I think Farrell will feature in a red in a green jersey next season. I just think at 6'5", with his, I suppose. Variety of skills, I think he'll offer something at national level that we haven't seen. The guy's the same size as Joe Rakakoko or Donica Ryan playing in the centre.
Yeah, Joe will be happy with that.
And his passing game left to right, right to left is really good. And he's been lucky in the fact that I think he's probably an under the radar coach. Mike Prendergast down in Grenoble has kind of been mentoring him individually for 2 years, so he's been drilling skills into him. He's not a gym monkey. He's been drilling skills into him, and he is a really good passer of the ball. Also, you have I think ever since James Hart has signed for Munster, I think his head has become free and his head is not cluttered anymore, and he's just gone out and he's played, and his GPS stats are hugely interesting. His capacity to cover the ground and the speed he can bring to the game has been very impressive. JJ Hanrahan, I always felt that, you know, when I can remember actually the afternoon I told him when the two of us were kicking, I said, I'm not going to be playing next year, JJ. And it was kind of that look like, as in, okay, you drive this ship. And, you know, I mean, I'm happy kind of handing it over to you because I feel that you can get the best out of Munster. And I think Munster would be good for you too, but it's weird the way it has worked out. But that guy is a hugely ambitious, determined young player. And you look at it for the weekend, you know, I mean, Sweetenham didn't start the game. There's massive competition in the backs, and the forwards will be more than competitive. It's what Kevin said at the start of the conversation. It depends on the mindset and how player driven it is and how much they want. I think the quality is there.
Do you still think JJ could do this? He could lead the ship?
I most definitely do. I think you know what I mean, let's not forget Tyler Blaindell didn't have a great day. A lot of out halves. Dan Carter didn't have a good game against Saracens in the European Cup final. But because these guys aren't Dan Carter, maybe they get a little bit more criticism. But a lot of out halves who have played against Saracens have underperformed a lot of capacity. It's one game, it's 80 minutes. Let's wipe the slate clean and have a go again. He can come back strong with a big finish to the season. Himself, JJ Hanrahan, I don't know what Ian Keighley's situation is, but I would think that between those two lads there, you've competition for a key position with Tyler, obviously, I would say, in the driving seat and deservedly so.
Kev, next level, next season with these two teams, are the signings, or is the development path that we see these teams on enough to push them up another level next season?
Yeah, I think, like, in Leinster's case, without trying to sound biased, I think most of the parts are there. I think they, like, some of their younger guys need a bit more experience at this level. A lot of them have got that now after the semi-final at the weekend. my concern would be when you look at a team like Saracens and the fact that they have three top quality players in every position now and the impact their bench made, and do, say for instance, does Munster have that depth there? Will they have the depth there based on the signings? I think the way Rog like talked about the guys that are coming in, I think they'll add huge value. But like, who are Saracens bringing in next season? What are they adding to their roster? And like, can Leinster and Munster in particular, and you know, the other provinces, hang in there and hang on to the coattails? And I so badly wanted an All-Irish final. It would have been...
I completely agree with you. I think we may be making the mistake, and I think we may have said it in the past, but for me, Saracens are 30% beyond anyone else playing the game at the minute. Not alone are they brilliant on the pitch, but their recruitment policy, as you said, is better than everyone. Look at their recruitment for next season. They've got players that they've really wanted, and whatever it takes, you know. You've Liam Williams coming in, who is a really, really good player, and I don't know how they're doing it, but they must have a really good accountant to keep their budget.
Creative accountancy.
Yeah, it depends what you read out there about their level of debt, but we'll leave that for the business podcast, I think.
Yeah, but they still level of debt or not, they still have to adhere to the rules.
Exactly. Right, thanks gents for that. We will be back with a chat about how boring it can be for players to work with the media.
The Hard Yards.
Now when the cups are decided, you're fine weather, but that's probably a 2-month period. You have to do the Hard Yards.
Hey, that's the name of the show.
Excuse the pun.
No, that's perfect. We're going to use that now.
I'm on a bonus for that, definitely. Yeah. Get that in.
The Hard Yards.
The Hard Yards.
On Sports Joe. Backed by Ladbrokes.
And we're back on the Hard Yards. Pat, you went to the Rugby Players Ireland launch the other week and spoke to Andrew Trimble, and he had an interesting point to make about working with the media. We'll play a clip now for everyone to hear.
One of the things that stood out from that, it was a great documentary after, I think it was 4 days in November that kind of came out, and yourself and Ulton Delan would have kind of came across very well. It was a nice admission you actually made, kind of talking about some of the media stuff you have to do, and sometimes you have to just go out and just kind of, you know, you can't really be yourself a lot of the time because you don't want to kind of say the wrong thing, or it might be, you know, looked at the wrong way. I remember I was speaking to Darren Cave soon enough after that, and he was like, thank God somebody finally said it. Like, you know, is it a thing? Did you have other players come to you and say, like, listen, we all think this, but, you know, thanks for finally saying it?
Yeah, no, I think quite often with press conferences, there's a game that weekend, so quite often, I mean, week to week, no matter who you're playing, you're going to say the same thing time and time again, and you're going to say, you know, it's a big big challenge this weekend, got to get up for it, can't take this team for granted, or it's an, you know, massive physical challenge, the intensity in Thomond Park, you know, all this stuff, it's all true, but you say the same stuff every week, and you know, you just always try and get that balance of, you know, we got to get our stuff right, get our game plan right, and just try and, you know, meet that intensity. You know, so many cliches and players as well as journalists. I'm looking at you here. You must be so fed up and bored of listening to this stuff. But you got to keep churning it out, because if you don't keep saying that, then you end up saying something stupid, or you come across cocky, or you come across defeatist. You know, one or the other, and you can't. You just got to get that balance. And you got to use the cliches, you know. They talk, maybe an example, you know, the press conference yesterday, I was asked, you know, about, you know, three big games left to try and make playoffs, and what did I say? We're all just looking forward to just taking one game at a time, aren't we? What a ridiculous, boring cliche, but it is true, you know. Potentially, you know, getting towards the end of the Six Nations, maybe the Wales game. Maybe there was an aspect of us, you know, thinking about England, and we didn't take it one game at a time. So maybe if we'd bought into that cliche, it would have been a healthy mindset for us. But you have to be boring. You can't not be boring. You just got to say the same old stuff everybody says.
Okay, so he's wearing his heart on the sleeve with that one, Kev, isn't he?
I don't know if he is. I just think he's being honest. I think like he hit the nail on the head. The players, like, I kind of feel like the players have to decide when they're going into a press conference, when they're speaking to the media, how they want to be perceived. Then there's a huge influencer on that, and that is the clubs. The clubs want the players to carry the party line, and that's fine, because...
Talk to us how that happens. So, I mean, you're set up for the interview that's presumably through the club, and then is there talking points you're given?
The club will probably tell you the day before you're going to be doing media the following day, and they discuss with you what the kind of key themes, because I think it's very important as an organization that you have a similar mindset, and that comes across in the media. I think that's very important. I also think you're always, I think Trimby alludes to it, like it's a fine line between seeming ill-prepared or seeming cocky, and like the last thing we ever wanted to do was give other teams ammo. Like that was always a huge talking point in the lead up to playing Munster. We do not, they have enough ammo coming down to play us. The last thing we want to say is, yeah, I mean, like, Rog is playing shite at the moment. We're going to beat them. Like, and then you can imagine that'll be plastered all over the wall in UL, and they'll talk about it five times in lead up, and then they'll talk about it just before they come out on the pitch, and it would just give them extra ammo. Like, and we used to talk about it all the time, like not giving teams ammo. And I think you have to be really tight. Like, it's one of the things you have to be tight on. And like, media talking to players a little bit like attack versus defence. Like, the media are trying to find an angle.
Yeah.
And the players are trying to just like tighten up their defence and be really tight in what they say. And like, it's not a particularly great combination from either side, to be honest.
Yeah, it's like, it's sometimes there's the perception that the media are out to get you, like, you know, and that like we're looking to kind of make up a big headline or kind of find some angle. Like, you are looking for an angle, but you're just looking for something interesting in it. Like, and sometimes you can just see the players kind of just freeze up and you're like, what's this guy want from me? Like, you know, and you're like, sometimes you just prefer if it's just a chat, like a one-on-one with someone. And although there are times where somebody might just say something and it's just in your head, just a bell goes off. Like, I remember a few years ago before Ireland played the All Blacks, and this is probably why players get a little bit cautious. Like, Keane Healy was being honest, and he said, we talked about the haka, and he was saying, I loved the haka as a kid, I hate it now. And I almost wanted to leave right then and there and go write that up, because I was like, oh my God, Keane Healy, just, we're about to play the All Blacks, and he said he hates the haka. Like, and that was something that, or maybe Healy might come out the next time and just go, oh, the haka is great, I respect where they're coming from, and like, and he'll done a bit of reading up about it. But you know, there are times when he does that, but then there are other times where, you know, the media might get banged on the head a few times. But you know, I remember a couple of I think it was when Olton Delam was coming up, his first time he was put in a mix zone with us, and he just kind of maybe let slip to us that it was just a kind of small slip of the tongue, but he said, you know, when I'm coming off the bench or something like that, and it was in the lead up to the England game, so you knew that Delam was going to be on the bench, but you just knew he's a young lad coming in, and you could have led with that as a story, you could have knew he's going to be there. But I don't think anybody who was in that circle of journalists interviewing him did it as a story. So we are looking for angles, but we're not out to get you. We're not always out to get you.
Rog, did you enjoy dealing with the media as a player? So there's a long silence there, lads.
No, because I think it's a fascinating discussion we're having, and I think it's hugely important and hugely relevant, especially what Kevin is saying, and all the points that have been made. I don't think the media are out to do players. I certainly I think that's really accurate. I suppose it depends on a number of factors. I think what annoyed players, I suppose, was just the consistency about how, is it going to be an opinion-based article or is it going to be an analytical article? And I think there was times as players you were frustrated because their opinions would change like the wind. And surely if you're playing the game for 10 years, you'd kind of be thinking that it may not change as quickly as you would like it to have changed. Getting back to your question, did I like dealing with it? I thought it was I had a very simple policy in my head. I thought wherever I got it from I presume my parents or my upbringing, I was honest and probably too honest at times, but I just felt I'd seen other people acting in terms of playing a game with the media, and I felt that I wouldn't be able to win that game if I was trying to manipulate the situation, because thankfully if you were lucky enough to play as long as I did, you know what I mean, they're geniuses at bringing up stuff you said in the past. So at least if you were honest in giving your feelings this time, you could manage that, and it was exactly how you felt, and you weren't trying to play games with them, which would lead to a road to destruction, I felt.
There's a headline for your pod anyway, media are geniuses.
But take that.
The various, you know, articles that you read, be it opinion pieces.
There's different agendas though, Pat, you'd agree with that. People have different agendas.
Yeah, oh yeah. Like there's you know, sometimes no, you actually have people coming in with an article in mind, like, and you're just looking for a quote to kind of back up what you're saying, like, yeah.
But like it's something that's hugely important too, the how the media portray you. And I know for years that I was portrayed as, you know what I mean, grumpy, rude, difficult. I probably was, but to my teammates, I would think I was the complete opposite. And they were the people I cared about, but I didn't probably think about the public perception. But that didn't really bother me, in the fact that I had a good bunch of friends from school. I had good people around me, but you can't be friends with everybody. But at the same time, it is really important, the public perception. And that's something I learned towards the end of my career, and something that's really, really, I think, the most important thing to me now is when you go back to Ireland for weekends, you're treated like a king. It's unbelievable, the public perception of you. But at times that wasn't the case. But did I manage that well? No. But I think Kev will say it, if you're playing a test game every weekend, your priority is performing for the 80 minutes, not in how. And it's difficult, pressurized situation, I'm not making excuses, but you look at, I think exact same would be, I mean, someone like Johnny Sexton would be perceived as difficult, awkward. Yes, he is, most definitely, but also he has a heart of gold and he's a warm person. You need to poke him to get a bit of fun out of him, but that's the way he is, because he kind of needs that to perform. And I think I can really, really associate with that.
But did you actually read all those, you know, all the pieces? Let's say it's by an ex-player. You hoovered it up,
read,
did
everything.
You?
Yeah. Read everything. I loved it. I loved knowing what was said about me, what was going on, because it was important just for me, because, you know, I mean, just to store that and kind of go, that's fine, that's his opinion. Other people had different opinions, but I just really felt like that I never went into a bubble so much, and that I'd restrict myself from what was going on in reality. I think that was crucial, and I think that kept me grounded.
There was a good bit of advice, Rog, that I got when I was maybe just starting to kind of cover the Irish rugby scene, and it was one of the older journalists said to me, if you're ever talking to Rog, just give him a compliment early in the interview and that'll soften him up and you'll get some really good stuff out of him. did you ever find people were being overly nice to you at the start of an interview? Ireland lost, but you had a good game.
No, but did you see, that's I think that's, but like, to be fair, Pat, these guys don't know me, you know what I mean? My teammates knew me, and I had some great relationship with journalists, but a lot of them wouldn't know you know, that kind of way. So they're giving their opinion on something, that on a subject matter, but they don't really know the person or the character behind it. They're judging your performance, and they're fully entitled to do that. But I think it's really important that you actually get to know the human side in all of this, because that's essentially what makes the biggest difference. Kevin will tell you that, like, there's so much to the team environment, to performing, other than the 80 minutes.
Speaking of team and 80 minutes, player ratings, that's something which you have various views on around.
First thing I go to after a game.
Really?
And anyone who says they don't is lying. I love Roger's honesty there. Like,
yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you hear
completely. That's it, Kevin. I can remember years I'd kind of, well, after the first few years when I didn't have the double header, the first thing, you go home on a Saturday night, you might treat yourself, have a burger and go to bed, and then you get up and you kind of, I have to get milk for the cereal. You don't have to get milk for the cereal, you can only get the Sunday paper.
Exactly.
If the journalist gave you an 8, you kind of come running back to the house into the floor, skid on the double knees and
if they give you
a
6,
laugh all you want, but this is I can remember, sure, it was
risky business.
I told that story before, didn't I, the one about myself and Guy Easterby, when we got 5 out of 20, and he goes, Rod, do you want the good or the bad news? Guy got 3, I got 2.
But so Kev, if you're there, you're hoovering up the ratings, whatever else, I mean, there's probably not a huge amount of time spent coming up with these ratings, like on the final whistle for the Sunday morning paper.
Andy, the players don't think about that.
Yeah.
They think that absolutely every person the way you're brought up to think of is that every one of those 80,000, their eyes are glued to you.
Yeah.
They're scrutinizing your performance inside out. Yet when you go to a game now and you're retired, people couldn't, half of them couldn't care less about the game. Half of them are supping pints. Half of them are just there to say they were there.
Yeah. Like the first...
Brief overlook of their performance, isn't it, on their ratings. And
yeah.
I got explained that from the journalist, because I actually rang up one or two journalists and I said, I disagree with that.
I'd say those were your exact words as well, Roger. Yeah.
No, I'm telling you. See, that's it. I don't, like, I've learned that a long time ago. If you give a fella a bollocking, what do you achieve? You feel great about yourself for 10 minutes, but what message have you given? It doesn't work like that. I think the most important thing is that if you have something on your mind that you feel you can share with somebody, you discuss it, and he may disagree or he may agree, and then I think there's a more powerful relationship going forward.
Yeah, like
more respect.
The performance assessment cycle for me was, I played a game on a Saturday, right up until Monday morning, Saturday night and Sunday was all about external feedback. That's what I judged my performance on, because I didn't really want to start looking at the game and thinking too hard about things. I was too sore, too tired. Monday morning, then it would be over to the coaches to tell me what I'd done wrong or what I needed to work on. And then Tuesday morning, I'd start actually taking a hard look at myself and saying, right, let's throw away all that other crap and start actually deciding myself how I can improve. And that was the cycle for me. And no matter what I said to myself, the external feedback I got, no matter how irrelevant it was, even if, I don't know, Gavin Comiskey had spent 15 seconds putting 20 player ratings together, that meant a lot at that time. By Tuesday, I'd forgotten about it and focused on myself again. But that was just the cycle I went through, and no matter how much I told myself not to go through that, that's what happened.
Yeah, but with the ratings, we would do that for Sports Show. At a minute, it's almost like an on the whistle ratings you'd have, and they prove very popular. They prove big talking points after a game. But there's been sometimes after a game, you might get 13 out of 15 players that you've been watching, you've seen something, but then some guys don't stand out. So you just have a quick check of the stats and you're didn't do anything wrong, 6 out of 10 or something.
You know what? That's what's dangerous too, because I know from coaching, stats are so dangerous.
Yeah.
I can give you just a live example. We played Montpellier, the Hawes, at the weekend, okay? I think we had 14 lineups. Down in our stats, we won, I think, 12 out of 14, okay? But how many balls did we play off? 2. What did the stats say? Success rate 12 out of 14.
Yeah, or did they contest them against you as well? Saracens were given Munster lineouts as well.
But you know what I mean? You win a lineout, is the second row or whoever taps the ball back, but it hops on the deck and you know what I mean? Skimmies away towards the touchline, and the backs are kind of gone, cheers. You know what I mean? It's just, it's all about quality. If we saw, it's the same as kicking stats.
So,
you know what I mean? The greatest kickers are the guys that don't attempt any kicks from you know what I mean?
Angles,
40
yeah.
meters, because they just want to protect their stats. And that's gone on 20 years. It's not just a new thing.
So going back to one thing earlier on, right? So Kev, you said that it's kind of attack versus defence. But do players accept, or is there an acceptance preached on by the clubs that the media and professional teams need each other? It's a symbiotic relationship here.
Yeah, sure. Something you said to me earlier, I have never thought about my entire life, that the rugby needs the media. It's always the way my mindset since I came into Leinster was that we need to protect against the media because the media are trying to find angles. And that's definitely a mindset in professional sport. And it's probably due to a small handful of journalists that have said particular things over my career that have made me say, Jesus, these guys are out to get us.
Are the journalists that, without naming names, the journalists that you would have encountered that you wouldn't trust, you would not deal with again?
Yeah, there are. And they're, I think, the worst type of journalism are the people who write really, really strong opinionated pieces on players and personal attacks at times, and they're the ones that don't show up at the press conferences as well because they don't have the balls to face the players or the coaches. And that for me now is the lowest form of journalism. And I'm reading articles on people I know well and good friends, and they're saying things about them that they shouldn't be saying. So that kind of stuff I think creates a gap and creates a level of mistrust between journalists and players. And no matter what way you look at it, the game does need journalism. And like, if journalists aren't bigging up like the Irish games and the Leinster semi-final and the Munster semi-final, etc., like, they're not going to be as big an event. Like, they're not going to sell as many tickets. And they're,
and there is a selfish side of this from the media point of view, in that, let's say you're a rugby journalist, you want rugby to be a bigger game. Mm-hmm. There's a part of you that has to want this industry to get bigger, because then there's more room for you.
We need each other.
This is getting very cuddly here. Yeah. Rog, I mean, would you see that now, after you've retired, do you see that sort of relationship of the both sides needing each other?
Yeah, absolutely. You see things completely different when you step out of the bubble. Completely different. As I said, it's a mindset that's driven on you, and that's just the way it is. And because you're in there and you're thinking about it, and it's been said all the time, you just become a victim of your circumstances, I would think, because you're not thinking maybe as sharply as you should as an individual, because it's all about the team, what's best for the team and how best to get the best out of the team. So if you're a real team player, you buy into this, and that's exactly what you need to do. I think in my case in Munster, I was lucky in the fact that and people's perception that the guy might be different, but Pat Geraghty was brilliant. Pat Geraghty treated me like one of his sons. It was his attention towards me. He really had took my issues to his heart, and I felt so, I suppose, secure, and I had so much trust in him. And I don't know what went on behind the scenes, and I'm sure, because Pat is fiery, I can only imagine some of the discussions he had with journalists.
I can attest to the fact that Pat has fire in him, yeah.
But like, in terms of him looking after me, like, take it from my point of view, I've asked Pat to kind of just keep an eye out for me. And once I said that to him, and you work with a guy for 15 years, I think that's a massive, important value in life, to have someone like that who is, even if I'm 90% wrong, he's going to back you. I think that's what, that's very important.
You're 90% wrong a few times.
But like, from a media point of view, that's bias, is it? Like, as in, if you know that a journalist is always going to write positive things about a team or a player, like, do people actually want to read that? And that's the challenge that media have, is they want to build trust, but they need to report independently.
Yeah, well,
then,
yeah, some get accused of being cheerleaders for or apologists for the Irish team if they're losing, and then that doesn't do any favours as well. And then you have other people that come out, and as we said, we saw there during the you know, the November series of Six Nations, one win you're up, the next you're down, like, and that must frustrate players like something crazy as well.
There are so many different types of journalism out there. Some of it, it's just content now, you know. And we're in a world where in America and in some places in England, there are clubs and teams who are just producing their own. They're saying, let's cut out the middleman, let's just do it ourselves. And I'm not sure if that's great, but I suppose, Kev, go back to your point, it depends what people want to see. We'll leave this...
It depends what Kevin's point saw is fact too, which is most interesting. It depends on the person that's writing it. I think that's all the rugby player asks for, is to get this guy to put his name to a piece, mm-hmm. and to have the decency to show up and to maybe potentially ask a question, as opposed to giving his opinion on something that he doesn't really know the person. That's hugely harmful and damaging to young players' careers, and it happened at TV level as well. You had young players whose careers were really affected by the opinion of one or two people, and that isn't right, because they're not getting the full picture of how this player is performing or what this fella does. So you have to protect the player as well. I think that's important as well. You can't just have somebody shouting down about this guy that he's no good, but he wasn't probably good today, but that doesn't necessarily happen every week, so just generalising is really dangerous.
We leave that one there. I think it's a talk we might come back to someday in the future. Rog, we'll leave you go. Thanks very much for your time. Up next, we chat about this weekend's Pro 12 action, and we'll get some odds from Ladbrokes' Hayley O'Connor.
The Hard Yards on Sports Joe, backed by Ladbrokes.
We're back, and we're joined on the line by Hayley O'Connor from Ladbrokes. Hello, Hayley.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. We are looking ahead to the Pro 12 action this weekend, and it's a funny table, Pat. Ulster have a big game.
Oh, massive game, yeah. Away to Ospreys on the Saturday, so that's afternoon kickoff. They need to win that game, basically. Like, I know Scarlets are in the mix, they're playing Connacht as well, but Ulster are a point behind Ospreys, and if they lose that game, that's them as good as done ahead of their final game of the season against Leinster.
Yeah, and if you look up the table, then Ospreys, Ulster, as you say, and then they play Scarlets in the final day. I mean, this is, it's the one interesting battle left, apart from the Battle of Italy, you know.
Yeah, well, if Munster go and get lucky enough to get that losing bonus point against Treviso, they'll get that home semi-final wrapped up, and so then Leinster have hosting Glasgow as well. So it's the amount of players that are actually going to miss. I think a lot of the guys who were battered themselves in Champions Cup action are going to miss out this weekend, so it's up to the other guys to kind of step up and actually make a claim to get a semi-final spot and a final spot. This place is to play for.
Ulster's odds of making the playoffs, how does Ladbrokes see that, Hayley?
Even money. I mean, as you said, like, Ospreys have home advantage and probably the second best defence in the Championship, but Ulster do know that defeat would likely end their ambitions of reaching the knockout stages. But yeah, we think it's an even money shot that they'll make the playoffs, and they're 16-1 for the to be grand final winner, so that's probably out of their reach.
Okay, and for the four Irish provinces this weekend, Pat, what were we looking at? Leinster playing Glasgow, Ulster at Ospreys, as we mentioned.
Connacht, they're at home to Scarlett, so that'll be their final home game of the season. So, unless we were talking about playoffs and stuff, we'll come to that soon enough. And then you have Munster away to Treviso on around 6 o'clock, I think, on the Saturday as well. So all they need, they're 9 points clear of the team in third place. So they just need 1 point to get themselves a home semi-final as well. And like, that's, we were talking to the Munster lads after the Saracens game at the weekend, and that's their big focus now, to get back to the Aviva Stadium, and whoever they play, they'll be happy enough to do that in the Pro 12 final.
Hayley, those four Irish provinces to win this weekend, I believe you've got an accumulator.
Yeah, 6-1 you can have, which I think is quite tempting.
Ulster, the big one, yeah. If they can do it, you could get yourself some money if you lumped on that.
Yeah, as long as Connacht decide they actually want to finish 8th as opposed to 9th. We might come back to get to that next week. It's a funny way this competition is structured this year. Last thing, we obviously been building up the Lions tour over the last couple of weeks, and will be next weeks to come. The betting that you're taking on the starting fullback in the first test. This is interesting. Hogg is a shoe-in to everybody, but there are some other candidates, Hayley.
Yeah, well, Stuart Hogg, he's, you know, Six Nations Player of the Year. He's the favourite, 4-6 odds on, to start at number 15. Lee Halfpenny is 5-2. He actually, his Twitter's that video that he has have been picked when his name is announced, which is absolutely adorable. But anyway, Liam Williams, then, he is 6-1. Will Greenwood, actually, is a massive fan of his, said that he's improved massively, and even though he doesn't look like a rugby player, that he's could be something really special. Jared Payne, who surprised a lot of people to even make the claim, he's 8-1. Anthony Watson, someone described him, I think, as having the most dazzling feet in the Northern Hemisphere. You can back him at 16-1 to start fullback. And Elliot Daly, versatile player, he's 25-1.
My tip, Liam Williams, gut feeling says that he'll be starting fullback.
Yeah,
don't know why.
Rog was talking about last week as well, wasn't he? Like, he was saying a guy he didn't exactly rate 100% as a player, but absolutely loves him as a coach.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thanks to Rog, to Kev, to Hayley, to Pat, to Joe Harrington for producing, and Shane Dempsey for looking after the sound. We'll be back next Thursday with a new podcast. Subscribe to it on iTunes, Podcast Republic, Stitcher, and every good podcast app to get it straight to your phone. I'm Andy McGeady. This has been The Hard Yards. Thanks for listening.
The Hard Yards, brought to you by Ladbrokes, passionate about sport.